listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an economist breaks down the cost of tickets to sporting events and concerts, why scalpers get into the game, and how to fix things. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. This week, the plan to close the Lincoln Hills Youth Prison north of Wausau is starting to move through the state legislature. And a candidate for one of Wisconsin's U.S. Senate seats is making national headlines for political differences with his parents. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
Well, Rob, let's start with Lincoln Hills. We checked in with you when Governor Walker first announced his intention to close the controversial youth prison, replace it with regional facilities. Now it's in the legislature. What's going on right now?
Sure. So there was a long hearing yesterday. That was a hearing, a joint Senate and Assembly hearing. And then the Assembly committee considering this voted unanimously to pass the proposals on to the full Assembly. So this is the first time that that legislators have heard and voted on this proposal, and the fact that it was unanimous vote, it certainly is a signal that there's a bipartisan consensus around this, at least among those legislators, and it sure looks like it is on a fast track.
Here's Republican Representative Michael Schrah talking about the sense of urgency, but also concerns that this is moving pretty quick since there's not a lot of time left in the session.
I think all of us would prefer more time and more details. But please keep in mind that we have a very short window of opportunity. 10 years from now, will our counties be proud of their programs? Will they enjoy greater public safety and more productive outcomes for these youth? Or will they be blaming us for not acting when the time was right?
And speaking of those counties, representatives of counties in the state are a little nervous about how fast this is going. They want to make sure it gets thought through pretty well. Right, Rob?
Well, they want to avoid being stuck with a large bill. A part of the proposal is a certain number of regional state-run facilities. Those would be designated for what the state would consider higher risk youth offenders. So serious crimes, violent crimes, would be held in these state facilities. The other youth offenders who are now in Lincoln Hills, or who would go to a facility like Lincoln Hills, would be held by the counties in their own secure facilities. And so, you know, if you're a county, if you're a person, you know, a county person, that is a concern for you that comes with a price tag, and that is a new responsibility that the state would be putting on the counties.
Governor Walker says he's hoping this does go through the legislature and reach his desk soon. Here he is talking about the plan this week.
I think so far the response has been positive, but I want to make sure that there's enough time to get this through not just the Assembly but the Senate. And it's something we stress to Senator Fitzgerald and others that we want to get this done. We think it's important to get this done yet this session.
He referenced Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, who I understand has expressed some reservations about the plan. What are we hearing on the Senate side, Rob?
Right, Fitzgerald expressed the most reservations of the among Republican leaders. So the plan will be taken up by the Assembly. It will go to the Senate. But Fitzgerald says, and he's not wrong. You know, the legislative session only goes until March. This is complicated. The proposals are complex, and so he's expressed at least some concern that. Other state senators might need more information. And so that could hold this up.
We'll keep watching this story. I want to turn to another crime and punishment related story, Rob. The housing of sexual offenders after they get out of prison is a tricky issue. One particular case now in Forest County is getting a lot of backlash. What's going on?
This was a fascinating story out of the Green Bay Press Gazette. Our reporter Paul Shrubis looked at this issue in this tiny little town. It is in the middle of the Chequamegon-Nicolet National Forest, and a judge has ordered that a 51-year-old sex offender will be placed in a little cabin in this small town of about 300 people in the middle of Forest County. And there are complexities to it, but as you can imagine, the people who live in that vicinity don't want this guy coming there, and they question whether the judge should be able to make that order to place this offender there.
And the thinking, I guess, lots of sites were considered. This is a remote one where the offender, on release, probably won't encounter a lot of people. But locals are saying, well, wait a minute. That means, you know, we're not going to want our kids going through this isolated area in the woods. There's worries about tourism and bad cell phone reception. If somebody had to call and report this person, they're bringing up a lot of concerns based on the isolation here.
Right, absolutely. I mean, and there was a report from the Department of Corrections really cast doubt, said that this was not a suitable place to place this offender on the grounds that it's near a campground, and so the GPS issue, the same as you described. So under the law, the way that this man has been committed, he's under a psychiatric commitment, and the state can hold him indefinitely, but is required to provide treatments to him, and he has the right to petition each year for his release, to make the case to a judge that he has made significant progress in his treatment. That is what the law requires in order for it to give the state the quite, extreme ability to, in theory, hold someone indefinitely. So in this case, a judge agreed that he had made significant progress in his treatment, and under a bunch of specific requirements, including GPS tracking, including specifics, he was allowed to be released. And this is how we got there. The Department of Health Services said that they looked at more than 3,000 possible residences to come up with this. With this location, the offender is from Forest County originally, but it raises this this interesting question, right? No community would probably want this guy. No community would welcome an offender like this, and yet by law, we can't keep every one of these offenders locked up forever.
And Rob, I want to turn our last couple minutes to a political story now in Wisconsin. It's an election year. The U.S. Senate seat currently held by Democrat Tammy Baldwin is up for election. Two Republicans, Kevin Nicholson and Leah Vukmir, running in a primary for that scene. Kevin Nicholson is in national news because of contributions made by his parents. What's going on?
Right. So Nicholson himself is a former Democrat. He got his start in politics as a sort of rising Democratic star. He was the president of the College Democrats of America, the national organization. He spoke at the 2000 Democratic National Convention. And then he was out of politics for a while. He was a Marine. He was a business guy. And his views on politics changed. He's come back as a conservative Republican in this race. It turns out that his parents, their views on politics have not changed. They are big supporters of the Democratic Party, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported that they both gave the maximum donation of $2,700 to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, who would be Nicholson's Democratic rival.
And Nicholson has been in national interviews. What has he had to say about that?
Yeah, this was, I mean, it's like, you know, it's personal, but this was in a, it's hard not to be intrigued. Mm-hmm. And on Fox News this week, an interview asked him, well, is it awkward at going to family dinners or whatever? And he revealed that he is actually not in touch with his parents. He said that that's a decision they made on the basis of their politics. And he's declined to give any more information than that. But, I mean, so we don't know how long they haven't been speaking, but yeah, it indicates that there may be a family rift there.
Interesting sidebar in a long-running race now. Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us each Friday to round up the top stories in state news. Coming up, an expert will walk us through the complex economics of the market for live event tickets, the sporting events, the concerts, and more. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the Trump administration wants to implement widespread changes to the federal food assistance program. Supporters say it'll save taxpayers money. Opponents say it won't help the people who need the assistance the most. We'll learn more coming up. First, you used to have to stand in line to buy tickets to see your favorite band or team play. But now buying tickets is much more convenient, with most of these sales happening online. But why do some tickets sell out so fast and then appear later on third-party ticket broker websites for a lot more money sometimes than the original price? Eric Budish joins us now. He's a professor of economics at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. He's here to shed some light on the messy world of the live event ticket market. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure. Thanks.
What got you, as an economist, interested in how tickets, event tickets, are priced? Why was this a problem that you thought was intriguing?
Oh, that's a fun question. So it's a market that's been screwed up for a long time, and it's a market that's associated with a lot of what economists call rent-seeking, so socially wasteful behavior. In this case, I got interested in it in part because my brother was doing some reselling of New York Giants football tickets. he was in college at the time. I was like, oh, geez, if even college kids are spending their time trying to buy tickets on the primary market and then resell them on eBay and StubHub, something about this market screwed up. And I work in an area of research called market design, which works on getting the rules of marketplaces right in the first place, so that then behavior by participants in the market leads to good allocation, socially efficient allocation.
Now, let me see if I have this right. A lot of people will look at the price of a concert, say, especially a big famous legacy band like, I don't know, the Eagles or something like that, or a sports event, and say, well, clearly the problem is ticket prices are too high. You say, no, they're actually too low.
Well, so I'll say two things, actually. So one is, I think there's a market clearing price, oftentimes for popular acts, you know, like the Eagles or Taylor Swift and Bruce Springsteen are doing big tours at the moment. The market clearing price, the price at which demand meets supply, is quite high, sometimes offensively high. Then there's another price, which is the price an artist might want to sell their tickets to their fans, because they think that price is fair in some meaningful sense. And I think my main point as an economist is, well, let's say the market clearing price for Bruce Springsteen tickets is $1,000 a ticket, and Bruce Springsteen would like to sell the tickets to his fans for $100 a ticket. From my perspective, if you set the price at $1,000, that clears the market. That's one sensible price to sell at. If he wants to sell his tickets to his fans at $100, I think that's also a reasonable thing for an artist to want to do. But what I think is diluted and what defies economic gravity is to sell tickets at $100 and then assume that they won't get scooped up by ticket brokers, ticket bots, and then resold on eBay and StubHub for $1,000.
That's where it gets tricky, because in that example you just gave, between the price tickets are actually selling at and the price somebody's willing to pay for them, there's $900 of profit that somebody could make. It's a kind of an open invitation for somebody to grab that $900, right?
Absolutely. And laws of economic gravity, someone, there's going to be competition to get that free money. And that has led to ticket bots. It leads to college kids in dorm rooms clicking the button on Ticketmaster. But it's not going that to get that $900 of surplus into the pockets of your fans, you have to redesign how the market works and shut down resale. So I think that the two choices for this market that reflect economic reality are either to set a market clearing price, so $1,000 in my example, or to set a below market price but take measures to ensure that those tickets make it into the hands of your fans and can't be profitably resold, because if they can be profitably resold, economic gravity says they're going to get scooped up by brokers, not by fans.
So let's look at the possible downsides of each of those. First of all, if you're a musician whose appeal is sort of your working class roots, like, say, Bruce Springsteen, a four-digit ticket price hurts your brand. It has an impact maybe on your other economic interests, right?
Yeah, it's not a good look. I completely agree. Taylor Swift's getting a lot of grief at the moment right now because she's trying to set market clearing prices for her tickets, and she seems to have overshot. And it's also not a good look there, too.
We're talking about live event ticket prices with economist Eric Budish from the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. So, Eric, that takes us to the other side. If I buy a ticket to Concert X, there's some sort of mechanism that says, Rob, you can't sell this ticket. You can't resell it, or at least you can't make money off of it. What are some of the methods that could be used or have been used to do that?
It's done very infrequently at the moment, but every time you take a plane, you can't resell your plane ticket at a profit. Right? Your name's on the ticket. You have to show your driver's license when you get to the airport. So we have other contexts in which there are rules in the market that allow, in that case, mandate, but either mandate or allow the shutdown of the resale market. So in concerts, there have been a few cases where artists have effectively done the same thing, require you to show your driver's license at the door or present the credit card you used to originally buy the ticket. And that makes it difficult, not quite impossible, but pretty difficult to buy low and then sell high. And I think that kind of mechanism is valuable for the market. If an artist wants to sell tickets at a below market price to their fans, they can do so if they shut down the aftermarket.
That sounds easier said than done in some ways, right? The way the tickets are sold now, if I want to buy them at a low price and sell lots of them, it's first come, first serve. I can buy a whole bunch of tickets. So how do you stop that?
Yeah. So if they're,
I guess if I have to buy them all in my name, I get it.
Economic gravity is if you can buy low and resell high, people are going to try to find a way to do that. And it used to be that the way to do that was to wait in a physical queue. Now you can do it with a computer. So the barriers to doing it are a lot lower. You have a lot more economies of scale, if you will, in the scooping up of underpriced tickets. So if you want to shut down that behavior, you have to ban resale. And I don't think this is a regulation necessarily. I think it's more. I would like resale bans to be an option for artists or sports teams. There's actually a whole lobbying organization called the Fan Freedom Coalition that exists to lobby against allowing resale bans. The Fan Freedom Coalition, which I think originally got funded by eBay and StubHub.
Who make money in part from resale of tickets.
Make a lot of money from reselling tickets. It lobbied to make it illegal for an artist or a stadium to ban a resale, because fans should have the freedom to resell their tickets.
Now, a problem I think I've seen you talk about elsewhere is, okay, I laid out $100 or whatever for a ticket, and I'm thinking in the back of my mind, what if I get the flu? What if something comes up at work or family or whatever? I can't go to the concert. Well, worst comes to worst, I can dump off my ticket, make a little money back on it. There's a resale ban. I can't do that.
I think that's a hard issue with a resale ban. I think you'd have to design it in a way that you could get your money back potentially with some kind of cancellation fee from the venue or from the artist. And somewhat analogously to plane tickets, if you buy a plane ticket and you can't take the trip, you can get some of your money back, but you often pay a an economically significant cancellation fee. And that's the airline's way of ensuring that you were serious in the first place. And it's not like airlines are the most sympathetic creatures in our economy, but in this case, I think they're closer to a good design than the concert ticket industry is.
I think there's a feeling of justice involved at the root here. When people are paying money to see a concert, okay, if the money's going to the performer I like, okay, I'm okay with that, and their crew and the people who are doing work at the venue. If it's going to the college kid who fired up their computer bright and early, we don't like that. Is there an economic justice angle to this as we look at who the money's going to when we buy a ticket?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's exactly the way economists, let me put some language around what you just said, which is the way economists think about the issue, which is the money could go to the artist. So what's useful about that is that that's a reward for artistic creation. That's a reward for innovation, for entrepreneurship. We have lots of ways in the economy we reward creation of new stuff that people like. So that economists like that. If the reward goes to the fans, it's not wasteful. It's generous of an artist to sell something that's in, quote-unquote, worth $500 to their fans for $100. And as you said, that might pay them back in other ways long-term with their brand or with record sales or with just general goodwill from their fans. And the thing that's just wasteful and that leads to wasteful activity is for that profit to get to go to brokers, because the phrase economist uses rent seeking. If you have $400 free dollars on the table, a lot of college kids are going to spend a lot of time, or really a lot of ticket brokers are going to spend a lot of money building bots competing for that $400, and a lot of that profit then gets dissipated in socially wasteful activity. My advisor liked to tell a story. Imagine there was a blimp leaking money onto Soldier Field. It was leaking $1 billion a year onto Soldier Field. At first, if you happened to be near Soldier Field and there was this blimp leaking $1 billion, oh, lucky you, you're, you can catch some free money. But if that's happening consistently, then a lot of people are going to spend a lot of money building very sophisticated drones to try to catch the money that's leaking out of this blimp onto Soldier Field. And you're going to spew this cottage industry of money catchers. And from a perspective of the economy, it's kind of wasteful. So you see socially wasteful activity in pursuit of profits in lots of different contexts where markets are misdesigned. And the phrase economists use for that activity is rent-seeking.
We'll leave it there for now. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. This is a lot of fun.
That was Eric Budish, professor of economics at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. We've been talking about the complex economy of live event ticketing. Coming up, changes could come to the food stamp benefits some low-income Americans receive, including what one Trump official referred to as a blue apron-style food box. We'll learn more after the news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday after 7:30 on The Morning Show, the primary election for the state Supreme Court is coming up. Learn about the candidates and the issues in that race Monday morning after 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, in its federal budget proposal, the Trump administration is calling for major changes to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, often called food stamps. The program benefits about 46 million low-income Americans by providing individuals and families with money to purchase groceries. Among the changes being proposed is something referred to as a harvest box, which would be sent to SNAP recipients. The box would have food items with a long shelf life, like cereal, canned vegetables, and shelf-stable milk. Administration officials say the change, with others, could reduce the cost of the program significantly over the next 10 years. Opponents of the changes have called them humiliating to the low-income Americans who rely on SNAP. Jamila Michener is an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. A lot of her research looks at the intersection of poverty and policy. Jamila, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be back.
Can you talk about SNAP as it exists now? Who is receiving these benefits? How does it work?
SNAP is a program that serves about 46 million Americans in any given year. That was the number in 2016. And it serves a large swath of people who are low income, but most of these folks are actually under the age of 18, over the age of 60, or disabled, right? So close to 70% of SNAP participants are in families with children, and a third are households with seniors or people with disabilities. So we're talking about the most vulnerable communities, and they rely on supplemental nutrition assistance, especially during times of economic downturns or during transitions between working between different jobs.
And as I understand it, there's kind of a sliding scale. If you're completely unemployed, you get more. But a lot of people who are working in lower paying jobs might get a smaller amount of SNAP benefits. Is that right?
Yeah, this is one of the ways that SNAP actually does a great job of not discouraging work, because you can get a job and still retain your benefits, although to a lesser degree. And this it allows the program to really act as a supplement to households that include people that might be working but have low-wage jobs that are not really providing enough for them to be able to meet all of their families' needs. So many of the people who are SNAP beneficiaries are indeed working, right? And that number has been increasing over the last several years.
Now, there's this harvest box idea in the Trump administration budget. As you've seen what's in the budget, how would this work?
So the idea is that if you receive at least $90 a month in SNAP benefits, whatever you receive would get cut in half. And instead of getting that amount in what normally folks would get it, not cash, but they get a card, something like a debit card similar to that they can take to the grocery store. So instead of getting the full amount on your card that you could go to the grocery store with yourself and choose what you like, given some restrictions and guidelines, you would instead get half of that amount on your card, and the other half would come in the form of a food package, which they're calling a harvest box. And that food package would include things like shelf-stable milk, cereals, pasta, non-perishable items, and canned items. And so less of an ability to go and sort of pick what it is that you want, and fewer resources for that, and more food coming to you in the form of boxes that would be distributed by state governments.
The Trump administration says this would be a money saver, I guess, buying in bulk here and sending these things out. First, do you think that is true? Would this be a money saver for the SNAP program?
I mean, the administration offers figures. They say over 10 years it will save $129 billion. It sounds like a lot, but it's not really clear how much this would save. One of the things that the administration doesn't offer is an explanation of how massive amounts of food are going to be distributed efficiently. And many people think that this would be a logistical nightmare. And it would be a nightmare that would be in the hands of the states. So maybe some states would figure out a system that works, maybe others wouldn't. States with large rural populations would be facing some unique challenges. States with large urban populations would be facing unique challenges. It's impossible to really know how much this is going to reduce costs, because we're in uncharted territory. This is not something that has ever happened on a massive scale in association with a program like SNAP. Honestly, it's not even something that's been proposed in the last several years. In all of the congressional hearings that we've seen about SNAP, we just don't know. I think any strong claims about savings are rather unsubstantiated, because there's limited direct evidence about how a program like this would work.
Talking to Jamila Michener from Cornell University, looking at proposed changes to SNAP, the food assistance program in the Trump administration budget, including replacing part of the debit card benefits, about half of it for many recipients, with a box of non-perishable foods. Jamila, there have been critiques of food stamps over the years, food aid, that people abuse the system, there's fraud, or that people, maybe they do need it, but they misuse the funding on frivolous things. Do you see this harvest box idea as part of that that background?
I mean, I think it's part of a larger effort to stigmatize and weaken supplemental nutrition assistance. So it's part of the trajectory of the kinds of criticisms that you're talking about. I think the challenge with those criticisms is that they're largely unsubstantiated. The best research that we have shows that SNAP beneficiaries don't make any worse choices than the average American household. So to the extent that we all are sometimes making not great choices about what to buy and what to eat, low-income people are no different, right? And evidence of fraud, again, is limited. I lived in Chicago for many years, and once in a while, did we see somebody on the corner trying to sell us their SNAP card in exchange for money? Yes. But anecdotal evidence like this, right? Sometimes people use this in the wrong way. It won't do, right, when it comes to making major policy. And the actual evidence that we have of fraud is really limited. What we know about SNAP tells us that it's a relatively efficient program, and frankly, it's a cheap program. It costs about $70 billion a year, which sounds like a ton, but when you think about the fact that the federal budget is in the trillions, SNAP is about 2% of federal outlays. So this notion that there's all this fraud and spending going on, and this is a problem, and it's affecting our budget really negatively, it just really isn't borne out by the evidence.
Want to invite our listeners to join in now at 800-642-1234. We're talking about proposed changes to food assistance from the Trump administration. It's in their budget proposal. Jamila Michener is with us from Cornell University. What do you think of these proposed changes, replacing part of the funding with a box of food? Do you think the government should make this change or cut backs in this program or expand it? If you receive these kind of benefits yourself, do you have questions about how these changes would work? Are you worried about them? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. At Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about proposed changes the Trump administration is proposing for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Our guest is Jamila Michener. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the basic idea for many recipients, cutting the amount they receive on their food debit card in half, replacing it with a box of non-perishable foods? If you currently receive SNAP benefits, what do you think of this idea? Call in at 800-642 or email, 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls now, Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I just find it very ironic that we've just given a huge tax break, which, you know, the supposedly refunded in your checks that are going to help mostly the people who make a lot of money. And we've been taking it out on the poor now. And then in Wisconsin, we gave $3 billion to Foxconn. We're going to give a similar package to the Kimberly-Clark Corporation. And now we're picking on the poor in Wisconsin. And about this fraud business, we have legislators in our federal government who have paid out thousands and thousands of dollars to hush money for sexual assault cases. What about that kind of fraud? Why are we always picking on the poor people?
Cindy, thanks for the call. Jamila, Cindy's saying government is more helping the corporations and punishing people who receive benefits.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important in precisely the way this caller is doing to think about a move like this in a larger context. It's not really about the harvest boxes themselves. It's about the political configuration and the policy configuration that they're a part of, which is moving towards taking more away from the people who have least and giving more to the people who have most. And we should be paying attention to that and responding. I completely agree.
Thanks for the call, Cindy. We'll go next to Mary on the line in Madison. Mary, hi.
Hi. My concern is for the nutritional value of all these products, you know, that are either canned or processed in some way. It's my understanding now that we encouraged our SNAP recipients to purchase more fresh foods and, you know, frozen foods. So this switch is rather perturbing.
Mary, thanks for the call. Jamila, that's a criticism some people have had, is that it doesn't look like there's any fresh produce in this idea.
Yeah, it really is a problem. I mean, one of the interesting comparisons that has been made has been to the food delivery service Blue Apron. And the retort that folks have had is, but that includes fresh fruits and fresh meats and fresh vegetables, and that difference is a primary difference. Interestingly, the administration hasn't really made an argument about health or well-being, really. The argument has been about savings and about cutbacks. And so, you know, you don't get those savings if you even get them. You don't get them without a cost. And it sure does seem like part of the cost is going to be at the risk of the health of low-income Americans.
We'll go next to Mary Lisa on the Menominee Indian Reservation in Kachina. Mary Lisa, hi.
Hi. I'm calling. I run the food pantry out of St. Anthony's Church in the Opit. And I want to, what your guest just said is 100% true. For the people who come to our pantry, we try to provide items with protein, and those items are perishable. And we also offer the non-perishable things, but we did away with the packing, pre-packaging of boxes, simply because when you give a family a box full of food and say, okay, here, this has Wheaties and peas and carrots, and no one in the family eats peas or carrots, they eat corn and green beans. You know, you're taking away their dignity of saying, okay, we need to have some nutrition, and we are receiving this benefit, and yet it just encourages people to have, it encourages waste is really what happens, because they end up with a box of food that it's not just about, oh, we don't like that. But, I mean, you know, when you go to the grocery store, you don't get handed a box of food and give me your, you know, it's just, it's ridiculous.
Mary Lisa, thanks for the call. I want to bring Jamila on this. She says there's an issue of dignity and of food waste here, Jamila.
I'm really impressed with the way that the callers are just hitting the nail on the head here. I mean, I think it's absolutely important to think about waste in multifaceted ways. And while folks are talking about stopping the sort of wastefulness of the SNAP program, which we have very little evidence of, we're promoting this harvest box proposal that is likely going to cause more waste, because sending people a box of food that they have no choice over is going to encourage them to just discard the things that they don't want. And that's natural, right? And it does connect to dignity, because the expectation that because you are poor, you shouldn't have any choice over what you eat, and because you are going through a difficult time and need to rely on the government, your choice can be taken away. None of us would want to be in that position. None of us would want to be treated that way. And I think it's important to think about policy, not just in terms of bottom line, but in terms of people. And people have dignity, and people should have choice.
Thanks for the call, Mary Lisa. We'll go next to Christine in Milwaukee. Christine, hi.
Hi there. I'm a landlord in Milwaukee, and I have many tenants that are on the food stamp program, and I see the food products they're bringing into their homes, and I'm always just shocked that there's things like potato chips and Fritos and the juice bottles that are sugar and colored water. There doesn't appear to be much healthy food coming in. And then I'm thinking, with these harvest boxes, you're going to give them pasta. That sounds great, but what if it just seems there's going to be a lot of waste? I would just wish there was some way we could do fresh foods, healthy protein and things like that. But
Christine, I want to jump in because we just have a little time left. Jamila, that's a common critique. People say, I see someone on SNAP benefits mostly bringing home junk food.
Yeah, two quick things. One is that a lot of people are bringing home junk food, right? And it's easy to point it out, to notice it when it's people who are living in poverty. But it's not a problem that's exclusive to poor people and not something to be responded to in a way that's punitive. I think that there's a role for informing people, for helping them to make better decisions, but not for controlling, taking away choice, and punishing. And there are better ways that we can design programs like this if we're really thinking about improving the health and well-being of low-income people. But that doesn't seem to be what this proposal is about.
We'll leave it there, Jamila. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Jamila Michener. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University. She joined us today to talk about some of the proposed changes in the Trump administration's budget plan when it comes to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. This is a story we'll be covering as it moves through Congress. You can share your thoughts on the issue. Thanks for all your calls. You can keep going on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Milwaukee band Field Report has a new record coming out next month. The band's frontman, Chris Porterfield, just visited WPR this week with his band. And talk with me a little bit about the record's first single. The band is performing tomorrow night with Bon Iver at the Bradley Center in Milwaukee. You'll hear our full interview with Porterfield next month, I should say. But in the meantime, here's Never Look Back by Field Report. Chris, tell us a little bit about the first single from Summertime Songs, Never Look Back. What's it about and how did it take shape?
Never Look Back is basically about maybe you've got to do a lousy thing and end it with somebody who's dragging you down. And it's about getting rid of that and kind of letting yourself off the hook for that. Being okay with being the bad guy in order to have this act of self-preservation.
That's hard. We might have to tap into something we don't like about ourselves in that case.
Right. In order to preserve the rest of what's good about us. It's like if something from the old days is weighing you down, get rid of it. It's sort of a windows down, elbow out the window, but it's also like a real honest sentiment too, just turn around, never look back.
Cut my hair with your pocket knife. I trust you with my eyes closed. I just need you to try. I don't need you to know. 'Cause I've earned what I've been going. I'm all about the day when we cut it all off. Where we throw it all away.
And maybe it's a little denial, but for a good cause.
It's all of that in one poppy Tom Petty sandwich. I don't know what that means.
Cool. Thanks a lot. Chris Porterfield there from the band Field Report. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, Wisconsin has seen some major changes in landlord-tenant laws in recent years. A guest tells us how that's affecting some groups of renters. We mark President's Day with historian Ken Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History and a lot of other books. He tells us how the role and the symbolism and ceremony surrounding the American presidency has changed over the years. And is it just you, or is pop music getting more and more and more repetitive over time? We talked to a computer expert who took decades of pop song lyrics and plugged them into this program he made up to find out how repetitive the lyrics have gotten. We'll find out what he learned. That and look at some of the top news of the day. It's coming up Monday here on Central Time.